Leviticus 25, verse number 10 says, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Hello, this is Pastor Wynn Greer of the Mount Lebanon Baptist Church in Vilas, North Carolina. We do appreciate you listening in today. And while we're right here, I want to take just a moment and invite you to come out and be with us at the Mount Lebanon Baptist Church. We are located 1 mile up Baird's Creek Road. That is just off Highway 105 South, just about 2 miles outside of the Boone city limits. You'll come to Baird's Creek Road. That's 105 South towards Fosco. And we're a mile up Baird's Creek Road, just above the Willow Creek Golf Course. You can find out more information, all of our service times, all of those necessary things, ministries, archived radio broadcasts, sermons. All these things are on our church website, as well as upcoming announcements. We will have Bible school coming up the first part of June. We're excited about that. So we've got a lot going on this year. And we'd love for you to come and visit with us. Our church website is mountlebanonbc.org. That's mountlebanonbc.org. And so we'd love for you to come be with us. We also want to take a moment to welcome all of our listeners on the different stations that we are on. Right here on in Boone, North Carolina, on WATA 1450. Also over in Bristol, Virginia on WZAP, that's 690 AM. And then in Watertown, South Dakota on KPGT, and that is 89.1 FM. And we appreciate the opportunity, but this is the Blessings of Liberty. That phrase is from the preamble to the Constitution. When we first came on, we had a little contest to see if who could figure out where that phrase comes from. And a few people knew where it originated, but it comes from the preamble to the Constitution, where it says, "And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." And the preamble, and it's fitting that our subject the past several weeks, probably coming up on a couple of months or so, I'd have to look back and figure it out, but we've been studying the United States Constitution, and then we went right into studying the Bill of Rights. And it has taken me a lot longer to get through the introduction and then just talking about the First Amendment. And that's, of course, the first in the Bill of Rights. But today, and we're going to continue on talking about the First Amendment. There's something going on or in our country this week. Today's newspaper has a very good example of why we need to go back as a nation. Now, once upon a time, this was standard history that was taught in our elementary schools to study the history, the origin, the United States Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and it was just the way it was. I believe we've sort of gotten away from the important foundations of the history of our country, but we need to go back and study and be familiar with these great documents. Just this week, the Supreme Court said, and I'm quoting from the newspaper, said in a 5-4 decision that the town of Greece, New York, did not violate the Constitution by opening its town board meetings with sectarian prayer from clergy, most of whom were Christians. So we're thankful for this decision by the Supreme Court. It's important here in North Carolina as well, because in this state, our state, Forsyth County, the County Board of Commissioners, just a few years ago, they had made a similar appeal to have their case heard before the Supreme Court, and of course they were denied. But this is very, very similar to what was going on in Greece, New York, because in Forsyth County, they were doing the same thing. They were having clergy, open invitation, come in, sign up, say a prayer to open up the meeting. It was not limited to just one denomination or even Christian religion, but any clergy in the county that wanted to could come in and could have an opportunity to open a board meeting in prayer. Well, there was a federal lawsuit filed in Forsyth in 2007. It took a few years to get through the court system, but anyway, they lost. And so this Supreme Court decision, same circumstances. I was reading in the newspaper today, one of the, I believe it was the vice chairman of the Board of Commissioners said as far as she was concerned, they could go back to doing what they were doing before. So we are glad for this decision. But I noticed in the same newspaper, Tuesday, May the 6th, 2014, in the opinion section, there is an article there by a man named Paul Waldman. And this is a reprint from the Washington Post, or he's a writer for the Washington Post. And the title to his article says, Supreme Court Wrong on Meeting Prayers. And there's one phrase in his article that I want to pick out and give an example of why we need to go back and study the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, because so many times people say things, they'll say, well, I'll just read what he said. He said, the case is about the borders of the Constitution's separation of church and state. That's what he says about it. The case is about the borders of the Constitution's separation of church and state. And here is my question. What borders is the man even talking about? Here's what kills me when I hear something like that or read something like that, when he is inferring that the separation of church and state is found in the Constitution. It is not found in the Constitution. It amazes me how many people, even well-meaning people, people that would agree with the Supreme Court's decision, there are so many people that believe that the Constitution has in it the separation of church and state. It does not have anything about the separation of church and state. The Bill of Rights does not have anything about the separation of church and state. The Declaration of Independence does not have anything in it about the separation of church and state. The phrase separation of church and state is not found in any of our legislation in America whatsoever. Yet this is fostered over and over again through media, through people that are in education that ought to know better than that, than to even say that. It is ethically immoral to continue to repeat it when it is not so. It is not found in the Constitution. You do not read it there. And so when I say it's ethically immoral to repeat that, to talk about the separation of church and state in the Constitution, like so many people do where they say that phrase, when I say it's ethically immoral to do that, what I mean is it is lying. It is lying to continue to say that because it is not so. If people repeat that, sometimes we say they parrot something, you know, like a parrot that just repeats what it's heard. You know, they can learn different words and things. And so that phrase to parrot somebody, and a lot of people do that. They just repeat something that they've heard somebody else say. Well, if somebody does that out of ignorance, well, that can be forgiven. As long as somebody will listen, and you know, if you heard somebody say the separation of church and state in the Constitution, and you said, excuse me, that is not found in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence, and you could show them, you could say, read it for yourself. It doesn't take very long. And they said, oh, you know, I never realized that. And I've had a lot of people that I've talked to that thought it was in there, but just did not realize that the separation of church and state is not found in the Constitution. I'm saying that over and over again because the message needs to get out there. So if somebody just says that out of ignorance, and they will be corrected and acknowledge that, that's forgivable. But if somebody knows better and does it anyway, then that is deception. They're being purposefully deceptive in what they are saying or teaching or trying to get across. They're lying about it. There's no other way to say that. Now, I want to today discuss or talk about the phrase, historically, separation between church and state. Where, in fact, does that come from? Because I'm telling you, you hear it all the time. You'll hear it in school. You'll read it in the newspaper. You will hear lawmakers talk about that. It is something that is on the news, on the radio, in the news or talk shows. I mean, it's constantly coming up, this phrase, the separation of church and state. Well, if it's not in the Constitution, it's not in the Bill of Rights, it's not in the Declaration of Independence, it is not found in any of our legislation. There's no laws that talk about the separation of church and state. So where, in fact, does it come from? And so that's what we want to look at today. Historically, the phrase separation of church and state is derived from a letter from President Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter. Now, I want to emphasize this. This is not in legislation. You hear about it all the time, separation of church and state. It's not in the Constitution. It is historically found in a letter, personal correspondence from the then President Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Association. This group of Baptists got together. They wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson. The letter from him is dated June the 1st, 1802. Now, if you know your history, you know that that is 13 years after the adoption of the Bill of Rights. So the First Amendment, 13 years later, this has been the law of the land for 13 years now. And the Danbury Baptist Association, this group of gentlemen, get together. They write a letter to the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, and they wrote to him expressing a concern. There had been a rumor at that time. So you hear rumors today or conspiracies. People talk about a conspiracy about this or a conspiracy about that. Let me tell you, conspiracy is nothing new. There always has been, there always will be conspiracies. Some are true and some are not. But there was a rumor, or there was this conspiracy that there was for coming up for consideration a national denomination, that one church would become the state church. You see, and I've talked about this many, many times before the American Revolution, the different colonies, most all of them, not all of them, but most all of them had a state-church relationship in the state. Here in North Carolina, it was the Anglican Church. The Church of England was the official state church. It became so in the year 1701 in the state of North Carolina. And it was also that way in the state of Virginia. There was much persecution of the Baptist people. And so the Baptist people, they were very concerned about guarding religious freedom, religious liberty. And so that was still raw at that time. It was still on the minds of the people. In the early 1800s, there were many, many people that were alive that could remember being put in prison for preaching the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And many Baptist preachers were put in prison in the state of Virginia for preaching the gospel. Patrick Henry was a friend to the Baptist preachers, and on more than one occasion, he went and defended Baptist preachers, Baptist pastors that had been arrested and put in prison for preaching the gospel. So religious persecution once upon a time was a reality in the colonies before the American Revolution. So in the early 1800s, 1802, this is still fresh on the minds of the people. So they hear this rumor that there's going to be a national denomination, and of course they're concerned about that. So they wrote a letter to President Thomas Jefferson, and here is his reply in part, 13 years after the Bill of Rights has been ratified. He wrote to them assuring them, the Baptists, the Danbury Baptist Association, that the wall of the First Amendment would keep the government from interfering in religious matters. He said this, "I contemplate with solemn reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Now I'm going to read that again because that is so absent from when you hear any talk about separation of church and state. What is the context of it? Where did the phrase originally come from? It came from this letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Association. They're concerned about the rumor of the establishment of a church, of a national denomination. And so he said, once again, this is where the phrase comes from, "I contemplate with solemn reverence." Now, when you have solemn reverence, you respect something, don't you? "I contemplate with solemn reverence that act of the whole American people." This was something that was generally agreed upon throughout the whole. So he acknowledges that, "which declared that their legislature should," and here's a quotation of the First Amendment in part, "should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," end of quote. Then he said, "thus building a wall of separation between church and state." The wall of separation is to keep the government or the government or the state out of the church's business. That is the intention of the First Amendment, not to keep the church out of the government's business. That's the way it is many times represented today, but that's the opposite of its intended reason. It was to keep the government out of the church's business. It was never intended to keep God out of government. Like so many today, they want every mention, every reference of God completely stricken from the record. And so you have this chorus of separation of church and state, separation of church and state. Get rid of the Ten Commandments. Get rid of prayer at public meetings. Run Bible reading or carrying a Bible or any expression of religion out of the schools, they say there's no place for that, and they cry out separation of church and state. But the First Amendment was never intended to silence the voice of churches or preachers or Christians concerning matters of civil government or expressions of religion in public places. Never was it intended for that. I want to read again the First Amendment in its entirety. First Amendment says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." And to me also, when we read this respecting an establishment of religion, it also means that they were not to respect one denomination or one religion above another. There should be no preference, lifting one above another. "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." Now, I want to say just a little bit about Thomas Jefferson. For the record, I do not believe that Thomas Jefferson was a Christian. Of all the founding fathers, he was one of the least likely to be a, what we would say, a born-again Christian. I do like Thomas Jefferson. I quote him quite often. He was respectful of the Bible, Christianity, religion as a whole. And at that time in America, you basically had the Jewish religion. You had the Christian religion. That's why we refer to a Judeo-Christian in the Supreme Court, on the walls, the Ten Commandments, in the Capitol building is Moses holding the law, the legislature. And so we have this Judeo-Christian heritage in America. I like Thomas Jefferson, but I do not believe he was a true Christian from his own account, from his own writings, but he was very, very respectful. He is the one that said the Constitution should bind down the government and keep them from doing evil. And that phrase, to bind them down, actually comes from the Bible. Thomas Jefferson did read and respect at least some of the Bible. Now, the phrase to bind them down, to take the chains of the Constitution and bind them down, comes from Psalms 149, where it's talking about the people and their relationship to the king. He said in the Bible says in verse 6, let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand. Well, we could talk there about the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. This is the right of the people that is being expressed in Psalms 149 in relationship to their civil government. And it says, a two-edged sword in their hand. Why? Verse 7, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people. There's a semicolon. Verse 8, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron. They did have a responsibility to not allow evil to go on. Verse number 9, to execute upon them the judgment written. So if they broke the law, the people were to intervene. They had the right. We're talking now about the Old Testament economy of the nation of Israel. If the king broke the law, the people had an obligation to correction. And so they had a two-edged sword in their hand. And they were to bind the kings with chains. That's the phrase of Thomas Jefferson, verse 9, to execute upon them the judgment written. There's the breaking of the law. This honor have all his saints. Praise ye the Lord. And so Thomas Jefferson, he was a reader of the Bible, and he quoted it quite often. I have a T-shirt that has a quote from Thomas Jefferson where he said once upon a time, resistance to tyrants is obedience to God. Once again, we get that teaching or that idea from Psalms 149. But for Thomas Jefferson to be so respectful of the church or the matters of the church in concern with the civil government is worth paying some attention to, because he was not a believer like so many of the others. He was not a Christian, but he never sought to ban God, Christianity, or the Bible from public life. He may not have been a Christian, but he was respectful towards religion and liberty of conscience. In his second inaugural address, I'm going to give a couple of examples from his writings. This is the writings of a non-believer, but he had respect for the Bible and Christianity, the Judeo-Christian heritage. In his second inaugural address, he said this, in matters of religion, I have considered that its free exercise is placed by the Constitution independent of the powers of the general government. What was he saying there? He was saying this in a nutshell: the government is to keep its nose out of the church's business. That's what he was saying. He wrote a letter in 1808 to the Reverend Samuel Miller. And in that letter, he said to Reverend Samuel Miller, he said, "I consider the government of the United States as interdicted by the Constitution from intermeddling with religious institutions, their doctrines, discipline, or exercises." How did he feel about it? He said the government should not meddle in the affairs of religion or religious institutions. If we were to bring that over to the day and time in which we live, what does that mean? If we were to follow the advice of Thomas Jefferson, that would mean that a health care law, and we could talk about whether that's even constitutional or not, but a health care law that would provide abortive services by employers would be against the separation of church and state, because there you have the state meddling in the affairs of religious institutions and forcing them to do something against their liberty of conscience. Last Thursday was the National Day of Prayer, and I saw several articles and headlines about something that James Dobson had said. Now, for many, many years, Dr. James Dobson was the head of Focus on the Family, and a lot of people maybe grew up listening to James Dobson. Well, he's still active in public life, and now he's associated with another ministry, but his ministry now has been involved in a lawsuit concerning health care, because as an employer, they're going to have to be involved in supplying abortive services, maybe not abortion, but morning after pills, birth control, things like that. Well, James Dobson, he's been very vocal about this, and he had said, and the headline said this, it said James Dobson rips into Obama. I don't know about, it's hard for me to, and I did go and listen to it, and it was a very mild rip into him, but what he said is what they were getting at. He called Mr. Obama the abortion president, but what he said in that, he said that, "I will not comply with your wicked regulations." And that was talking about the providing of the what was being provided in the health care law. Here's an example of government getting into the business of religious institutions. There are many different groups in our country going around trying to ban prayer, Bible study, at school board meetings. There was on the news this morning, a teacher, a little boy had brought a Bible to school, and she had just flat out told him, "What are you doing with that Bible here?" And it was a big uproar. I'm sure you could find it if you wanted to, but this goes on all the time. Historically, there's no precedent whatsoever for that. I seen a while back where the football coach at Clemson was having, I don't know, prayer, Bible study. There's this group from Wisconsin called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and boy, they're popping up all over the place, in schools, coaches, sports teams, Bible studies, trying to ban any mention of God in the public area or arena. But historically, our government, our history, when we're talking about the First Amendment, is not trying to kick God out of everything that the government does. In 1777, our time's quickly getting away today, but in 1777, there was an appeal made to Congress at that time concerning a shortage of Bibles for our troops. And Congress got together at that time, and they appropriated money to purchase and distribute into different parts of the states of the Union 20,000 Bibles. Congress did that for the troops. So they were not for kicking God or the Bible or Christianity out of everything that government was involved in. They said this, that the use of the Bible is so universal and its importance so great your committee recommends that Congress will order, and it said from Scotland and different countries that they could get Bibles from. But that is not the historical precedent to kick God, the Bible, prayer, out of every vestige of public life. It's dishonest to say so, or to claim the separation of church and state. So we've enjoyed going over this. We hope you've got something out of it. This has been the Blessings of Liberty radio broadcast brought to you by the Mount Lebanon Baptist Church. We sure appreciate you listening in today. We hope you have a great day and a great rest of the week. God bless is our prayer.
News and information.